With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the History of Byzantium, episode 229, John Komnenos with Dr. Maximilian Lau. Today we talk to the man whose research has guided our last few podcasts, Dr. Maximilian Lau. Dr. Lau is adjunct professor of economic history at Hitotsubashi University in Tokyo, and also a research associate in history at St. Bennet's Hall, University of Oxford. He's been studying 12th century Byzantine history for many years now, and the fruits of that labour can be found in his forthcoming book, Rebuilding New Rome, The Foreign Policy of John II, Komnenos. The book is written and will be out next year, and Dr. Lau very generously shared it with me in advance. It's been incredibly helpful, in part because of its quality, but also because it follows a format similar to our narrative episodes. It is a chronological account of John's military and political activity, with a discussion of the sources as each incident unfolds. As Dr. Lau explains in the interview, John's reign often gets short shrift in popular Byzantine books because our Roman sources cover him fairly briefly. But there are plenty of other sources to work with, and Dr. Lau has synthesized them to create a new history of John's reign. This book has similarities in style and structure to Anthony Koldelis' book, Streams of Gold, Rivers of Blood, which I also highly recommend. But Dr. Lau's book goes one further and has a superb collection of photos from sites all across the empire. Most of these were taken by Dr. Lau during his travels while researching the book. As we discuss in the interview, many of the forts John captured or built still stand in Turkey today. Before we begin the interview, I thought I should just touch base with you all about our Roman sources for this period, Nikitas Koniates and John Kinnamos. We've talked about Koniates before. He's the one who says that Anna wanted to kill John and become empress herself. And as you may recall, he was writing after the sack of Constantinople in 1204 AD. Kinnamos, too, wrote later during John's son's reign. Now, I will be talking more about Kinnamos and Koniates when we get into Manuel's story, but several listeners did ask why we don't know more about John the person or his domestic agenda. And the basic answer is that neither of our Roman historians actually witnessed John's reign. But for a more in-depth answer, let's talk to Dr. Lau. Dr. Maximilian Lau, welcome to the History of Byzantium.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. As I said in the introduction, I was absolutely thrilled to get to look at your book before it's published. It's been our guide to John's life, and it's wonderful to talk to you now. First off, could you tell the listeners a little bit about yourself? What led you to Byzantium, and then why John Komnenos?
Of course, yeah. So I mean, like most people, I mean, I did mainly modern stuff through school. But then I was lucky enough for my undergrad degree, you had to do a bit of medieval and a bit of ancient, you know, in order to get a history degree. And so initially, because I was forced to, I suppose. But then, yeah, I mean, I, you know, like most people, I sort of, you know, started reading about the First Crusade and then heard about this Byzantium thing for the first time. Yeah, I mean, sort of, and then, you know, I was very lucky in that sort of Paul Magdaleno, who is sort of the big name for Manuel Comnenos, who I'm sure sort of you'll be hearing from a lot more in future episodes of the podcast. He was actually sort of my undergraduate tutor and therefore sort of taught me about Anna Comnini. There was a whole module on this kind of thing. And then even at that point, kind of, you know, because obviously he talked a lot about Manuel and then sort of Alexios. And then, yeah, there's this sort of John guy in the middle. And so even as an undergrad, I sort of thought, oh, this is a bit weird. So there's nothing written on a whole emperor. And then for my dissertation kind of thing that came up, I then said, oh, well, how about this John guy? And then I think the my supervisor there sort of laughed at me and more or less said, oh, yeah, that's at least a doctorate. You know, good luck, you know, finding anything in that black hole of sources. And, you know, and so, you know, I ended up doing something on the Varangian Guard, actually. But then, yeah, I was lucky enough to, you know, get some funding and stuff. And so sort of, you know, ended up doing my master's and then doctorate on John, just to, I don't know, just to prove that, you know, actually you can find some light in this black hole. So, yeah, that's, I suppose, my path to John was, you know, obviously very fortunate with the odd grant. And otherwise, just realizing that, oh, there's a lot written on Alexius and there's a lot written on Manuel and there's nothing on a whole emperor in the middle.
Yeah, well, we are very grateful to you for stepping into the breach. And something quite different to a lot of books that I end up reading for the podcast, you actually did extensive field work. And so there's wonderful photos throughout the book of places where John was or John's army built things or occupied things. Can you tell the listeners about your travels, some of the places you went, and how it informed your understanding of John?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I mean, it's certainly the fun part of the whole research thing. I mean, it's still, you know, 90% time in the library, you know, probably 99%. But yeah, this was the good bit. And yeah, it came up when, I mean, I was reading kind of in some of these sources, it says, oh, John built a fort or he occupied something, as you said. But then, you know, there's no, and then I Googled that place, as anyone would, sort of, you know, show me, you know, what is this? I mean, is it a massive, you know, invasion-stopping fortress? Is it a glorified watchtower? You know, is it near a town? Is it near a river? Is it the middle of nowhere? You know, what is this thing? And then, yeah, my supervisor then just said, well, I mean, if there's no pictures of this and there's no studies on this, then you should probably go visit. And this was kind of a bit sort of revelation kind of thing. And so more or less, I contacted the British Institute at Ankara, who were very, very helpful on this kind of stuff. You know, sort of used their library there, used maps, rented a kind of big old Toyota Hilux thing, and, you know, kind of took to the road, really. And so I've done kind of, well, several sort of trips, I mean, particularly sort of also in Serbia and places as well. Even Iran slightly memorably, but that's a whole other story. But so Turkey-wise, yeah, no, I sort of did, I mean, most of sort of John's sort of broad campaigns that you've talked about in the last few episodes, I mean, I more or less tried to kind of just follow these. I mean, so one particular example would be then sort of just sort of I've after Istanbul flew into Konya, sort of, you know, Iconian kind of thing, and then went sort of, you know, to the lake of the little islands that you talked about in the last one, and then down to kind of the more tourist friendly city of Attalia, and then kind of along the coast, kind of following that sort of, you know, that sort of great campaign of John all the way to Antakya, you know, Antioch. And yeah, loads of these places, you know, are completely uncurated. I mean, there's no kind of exit through the gift shop kind of thing. I mean, they're still, I mean, some of them are sort of very wild. I mean, as another example, I mean, finding them is part of the problem. I mean, so Ankara, sort of one of these sort of fortresses he builds, and it's sort of mentioned, you know, Koniatis, whoever, he builds a, you know, sort of a fortress at a place called Ankara. And then we know that this thing is roughly where it is, you know, sort of river-wise. And then I find a kind of, I don't know, 19th century archaeologist who encountered this thing near a kind of small village called Belakasir. These days, Belakasir is a huge city. And so, okay, where is this thing? And, you know, I sort of turn up, I go to the archaeological museum, I say, you know, where is this, with a kind of a, you know, grainy black and white photo of some variety. And then they shrug their shoulders at me. And then you kind of just go around trying to find these things, roughly sort of following the river or following, whatever landmarks you can. And then in that particular case, it actually, there's this kind of, 19th century thing of kind of rolling hills and then the sort of fortress coming out of it on like a Welsh fort or something. And actually, there's a modern hydroelectric power station there now, and it's kind of at the side of a lake kind of thing, and obviously there's huge great gates and everything else, but fortunately the sort of the guards and stuff were more than happy to see someone and have tea, and then you could sort of poke around, and these kinds of stories, sort of round Antioch as well, to see the old walls, more or less there is what is essentially a sort of Syrian refugee camp, but again there they more or less sort of see someone coming. They say, who are you? Where are you from? Like, they're very friendly, mixture of kind of English, French, Arabic, Turkish, whatever. And then you kind of say, manage to get out, kind of, I'm looking for, the Justinian's Gate or whatever it is. Basically the local kids say, oh, sure. And then you sort of go around these trails and everything else. And there it is. But, it's completely unlike, I think any of these sites, were they in Western Europe, would be, fantastically curated and gift shops and everything. However, lots of Turkey, it's completely out in the wild and you're the only person there and you can just kind of clamber all over it. It's a fantastic thing to do it. I'd say it was absolutely essential just to work out a few of the problems also. Because, sometimes one source says, he went this way. And another source says, he went the other way. And then when you actually go there, you realize there's no possible way you could have gone this way in winter. The terrain is completely treacherous. It was probably worse back then. And so really just sort of sorting out to some of these problems are very obvious when you just go on the ground kind of thing. Plus, I said it was a fantastic break from the library. It was a great thing to do, really.
And I suppose because forts, obviously are all built up on hills and isolated spots, the modern world hasn't built over them. And so lots of them are still there and there are interesting ruins to discover. And that's one of the real pleasures of the book, is seeing all these places and realizing what's still out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and it's because lots of the sort of the classical cities down on the plain, back when things were safer and you didn't need forts. And then you get, the medieval thing usually just up on the hill above. And that's the case, whether it's Serbia, whether it's Kosovo, whatever.
Excellent. As you mentioned, most of your time was inevitably in the library. So we should talk about written sources. Something listeners wondered was why we didn't know more, personal anecdotes about John. And as I've hinted, I will talk to them more about our two main Byzantine sources, who both came along after John's reign, sort of why they're not telling you stories about their memory of him wandering through the capital or whatever. But you had to work hard, I think, to find the non-Byzantine sources and sort of line up the chronologies and work out who was telling the truth and who had a better idea of what John was up to than people back in Constantinople. So could you talk about those non-Byzantine sources and how they helped you piece together the narrative?
Sure, happy to. Yeah, this would be the sort of the black hole that the my old supervisor referred to, because essentially, yeah, there is no basic text that just says who did what to who in what order. Which even if it's biased and terrible and faulty, at least gives you a starting point for most reigns. Whereas there is only this sort of, as a very short sections from both Kinemos and Koniates, as you said, who both of them actually admit, say, we actually don't know all that much about this guy, and so they more or less forms the kind of prologue of both of these. And so in sort of Koniates' case, John's reign is almost a kind of not quite a century before when he's writing, but he's this sort of like great hero from which all of these other emperors decline. So it's kind of, Koniates only has the good stuff, really. And he massively changes the chronology, whenever he fancies it, to put in a battle there. And then it sometimes even says kind of thing, but I didn't mention this, or, I'm putting this here for dramatic effect. So Koniates, has those issues. Whereas Kinemos, Manuel is his hero. And therefore John is kind of the sort of, the father who, so in some ways he's the kind of, the great father of the even greater son. In other ways, he's the sort of, not as good as the son sort of father. And so, you know, you've got these real issues with the texts, which, you know, are the only things that say, yeah, who did what to who in what order. However, exactly as you say, there are a bunch of things which kind of fill these gaps. And what's great about it is that, A, these aren't written by, sort of essentially academics sitting in Constantinople. I mean, lots of these texts are, you know, sort of more regional. So particularly I'm thinking of, you've got your sort of Armenian texts and Syriac texts. So this is kind of, you've got Patriarch Michael, the Syrian, who, particularly being a Jacobite Syrian Christian, therefore he, you know, doesn't like the Catholics, doesn't like the Orthodox, I mean, not the split is, you know, there, but, you know, obviously doesn't like the Turks either as an occupied power. Therefore, he doesn't really have this kind of horse in the race. You know, he sort of dislikes everyone equally. And therefore, he's actually very honest about sort of what's going on kind of thing. And, you know, he's sitting in kind of modern Eastern Turkey kind of thing, but is also very well informed, it seems, even about things in the Balkans. There does seem to be a Jacobite sort of Eastern bishop at John's court. And so possibly this guy is, you know, sending reports back somehow. Equally, you've got, the Armenian as well. And so particularly for sort of the Crusader stuff. You've got the Armenian sources, you've got Arabic, particularly so John is quite well remembered in some of the sources later kind of thing. So Ibn al-Athir, Ibn al-Adim kind of thing, sort of even though they're writing again about a century later, this is quite well. There is one thing from the time, sort of this guy Ibn Munqid, who is from Shizar, the sort of the city that sort of John lays siege to for quite a while. And so he's a boy at the time, but he writes this kind of journal as well. The Crusaders, particularly William of Tyre. William of Tyre kind of holds John up as, he's sort of a bishop of Tyre, and he sort of holds John up as kind of a symbol of kind of cooperation between, Latin Crusaders and, the Greek Christians, and say, oh, yeah, under John, this all worked out well. I mean, occasionally, you know, you had, he has this kind of memorable description of some of the Crusader leaders playing dice in their tents while John is kind of fighting on the front line. And says, well, really, I mean, if had the Crusaders backed John up at this point, this would all have been better. William, of course, is recruiting for the Third Crusade while he's writing all these things. So, of course, right. You know, again, this is a slight issue here. But otherwise, I mean, the main thing, really, aside from the buildings we just mentioned kind of thing, which sort of, you know, give you a bit of a cross-section of kind of archaeology and text, the real great thing for John's reign, once you got into it, are these court texts. So you've got sort of letters and speeches and things. And I mean, the way this worked really is that, you know, John would sort of, or indeed Alexius Manuel, whoever, would sort of send kind of dispatches back from the battlefield saying, you know, oh, I just won a battle or whatever it is. And then we have this sort of described that these kind of guys at court would essentially turn this into a sort of a speech, a poem, to be kind of formally presented either at court or alternatively to the people. I mean, during this triumph he has after sort of capturing Castamon, these triumphs, we have these kind of poems that were essentially sort of sung out at kind of this particular forum or in the Hippodrome or at Hagia Sophia, which kind of, you know, tells the story of the triumph. I mean, the best kind of modern-ish, equivalent would be something like Tennyson's Charge of the Light Brigade, which, you know, was a sort of a poem he wrote about, you know, the Battle of Balaclava and the other charge and stuff. And the kind of, if that is your only, you know, sure, it's poetic and it's, you know, sort of say, oh, how wonderful it is and everything else. But at the end of the day, it does tell you there was a battle at a valley, they charged down the wrong one. It gives you the basics kind of thing. And so lots of these kind of court texts are, you know, a fantastic window also into John's reign kind of as it happened. So as much as, you know, sure, Kinemos Coniates there, most of a century later, you know, 50 to 100 years later, you have that compared to these court texts, which give you a kind of blow-by-blow as it happened version. So, I mean, not quite the closest thing to a newspaper, but almost. So, yeah, I mean, John's reign was basically a bit of a jigsaw puzzle because there was no who to what to who and what order source. But with all of that, actually, there was a lot. It just took a while to get through, really. So, yeah, hopefully that answers the question.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing. Once you start going through all the sources available, you feel like, oh, actually, this isn't a black hole at all. It's just no one's taken the time to go through it all. And that's one of the really interesting things from my point of view is when you point out the differences between what was said at the time in court rhetoric and then what is later remembered. Mm-hmm. And maybe the court rhetoric actually hints at things that later on it's convenient to forget or smooth over or what have you. Well, obviously, I encourage people to read the book to find out more. But so the one thing we are really missing is someone who sort of lived or worked with John, who could give us sort of insights into what he was like as a person. And several listeners sort of said, you know, I've enjoyed these episodes, but it's all battles and campaigns and very little about what he was like in private life or as a person. Do we have hints of that? And what sort of sources can give us any sense of what he might have been like?
Yeah, so I said this is the wonderful thing about some of these letters and things, because and also comparing it to what little there is in your main texts, Koniates and Kinemos. Because in Koniates, as I mentioned, he's this kind of fantastic warrior emperor, and he's, you know, and there's one paragraph right at the end, you know, John has died, and sort of Koniates is summing up. And then he sort of said, you know, gives this image of this kind of, you know, sort of Spartan warrior emperor. He sort of has this brief thing about John discouraging court fashions and hairstyles, and, you know, basically, you know, imposing a kind of military discipline on the court. And equally that sort of, you know, he built churches and monasteries, and, you know, essentially he's this kind of, you know, Spartan pious kind of figure. However, also sort of, you know, deeply moral, he does mention kind of thing that apparently he abolished the death penalty. Which is interesting. There's nowhere, but you know, no other mention of this really. But it's quite interesting that Koniates even says this. And so, I mean, this is kind of, you know, this one paragraph. And if you read sort of lots of histories, that's kind of, you know, what people have to work with. However, you do have, as it from these court texts, a few other things. And also, the other one is you have the foundation charter for the monastery he and his wife founded, which I think you've sort of mentioned in the second episode. On John, sort of Christ Pantocrator, the sort of, it's now mosque in Istanbul today. And you have, this is the only thing we have that was actually written by John. I mean, probably ghostwritten by, you know, maybe a monk or something, but even so, what is fascinating about this, and I, is that you do have sort of John sort of, you know, thanking God for, you know, sort of preserving him from, you know, sort of, you know, troubles with his family, and sort of, you know, giving him victory over various things. And then, of course, particularly he has what I and sort of a few other historians have noted is kind of a fairly unique declaration of love, actually, for his wife, who has just died at this point. I mean, just to sort of read that out, sort of, he says in one particular paragraph, for through God's help, I found to share the monastery's planning, construction and completion, my partner and helper in life. That before the complete establishment of the task, she left this world by thy mysterious decision, and by her departure cut me apart and left me torn in two. This is an almost unique declaration of love of an emperor for his wife. I mean, I've actually looked around, and I mean, most emperors, of course, you know, have 10 mistresses and all this kind of stuff. And so, I mean, that's very interesting in and of itself. And so, I mean, I think the sort of the family aspect is something that sort of, you know, does come out in a bunch of sources. I mean, you know, sort of John's brother, who initially is his loyal, you know, follower sort of at, you know, sort of their father's death, and then sort of, you know, briefly tries to launch a coup kind of 12 years later. However, you know, for this one as well, I mean, sort of John apparently sort of takes him back, forgives him, you know, prodigal son style at Antioch. You know, equally the fact that sort of Anna as well, she, you know, seems to be, you know, quite happily, you know, seeing her kids married at court. Her husband is still, you know, John, one of John's right-hand man. I mean, I think sort of, you know, John seems to be sort of, if anything, overly forgiving. It's also interesting, I thought, so he and his wife have 8 kids, and they're all named after his siblings, who, when they're being born, would have been the ones sort of semi-conspiring against him. And I found that's quite interesting. You know, he's got, you know, sort of, you know, he has a daughter called Anna, more or less in the context of sort of Anna maneuvering against him, which is a bit interesting. So I think sort of, you know, John is kind of, you know, the family man is quite sort of something that comes out a bit. The other one on the sort of the fashion stuff, I mean, there seems to be John sort of military, sure. But I mean, there seems to be some basic heraldry stuff going on with it mentions sort of one of his brothers kind of, you know, purple by birth, kind of, yeah, born in the sort of the purple palace, but blue by rank. So these kinds of sort of phrases, which then in the later periods, sort of 100 years later, you have a very fixed sort of court system of, oh, you're that title, you wear this color and that crown and everything. And it seems to be John may have been the one who, you know, along with Alexis and Manuel, who sort of started this a bit. And so therefore seeing him as this sort of guy who, you know, imposing kind of, you know, whatever, is maybe a bit too strong. Military, yes, but, you know, military pageantry as well. The other one was just to sort of say, I mean, so, you know, just to think, oh, you know, he's, you know, just this sort of warrior and everything else, is the fact that, of course, he dies early. There, you know, had John had a retirement in Constantinople, because most emperors, you know, campaign when they're younger, and then they have a few years in Constantinople where they do other things. Had he lived for those last years, then we might have a very, very different image, because he patronizes a revision of canon law, equally of civil law. And so, I mean, I wonder whether there would be this image of kind of, you know, John the lawmaker, you know, Justinian style, had he had a few years in Constantinople to, you know, sort of, yeah, do this. So kind of, you know, whether that would be sort of something that, because he seems to be very, you know, very into this sort of legal stuff. Likewise, there is this, just to give you sort of, you know, a completely other perspective, from one of these court poets, we have a few texts that are addressed to John that are essentially parodies, satires, and to be honest, kind of a bit sort of, you know, bawdy kind of thing. I mean, well, this is kind of soldier's humour or what exactly? So particularly this court poet called Theodore Prodromos, who's forever also, you know, asking for money because John's always away rather than, you know, paying him for poems. He has one particular anecdote, you know, so and this is kind of addressed to John, and it seems to be probably to have been the sort of thing that had been presented after dinner or something. And then it has essentially the story of this kind of beleaguered husband who then, you know, so basically goes out and gets drunk. And then he comes back and his wife and kids won't let him in. And then he's sort of, you know, trying to sort of, you know, force his way in with this sort of broom handle, you know, through the door. And then sort of, you know, basically in the sort of the punchline at the end is sort of the wife just saying, you know what, this reminds me of our wedding night. So, you know, this is, you know, addressed to John, you know, presented to John. So obviously, you know, he can't really be this sort of Spartan guy with no humor, really. kind of thing. I don't know if you want to edit that out later.
No, that's great.
anyway, just to sort of summarize that, therefore, I think part of this is just because you have mainly the sort of Coniates Kinemos view of John as this kind of, you know, guy who conquers and sort of, you know, saves the empire and otherwise, you know, sort of move on to, you know, more, you know, tortured and, you know, difficult figures. Therefore, you have this, you know, you have this image, whereas actually had A, John lived a bit longer, and B, had a better biographer at the time, then you would have had quite a few different things.
Yeah. I should have asked this listener where they heard this, but they said, I've heard John is the Byzantine Marcus Aurelius.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so is that, and I wondered if that had come from what you were talking about, the reforms and thing, you know, that he was putting into place.
Yeah, a well-read listener, definitely. So this is the exact line which Gibbon uses, you know, sort of the great, you know, what sort of 18th century historian of, you know, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. And obviously, Gibbon usually hates everything Byzantine, you know, sort of classical Rome, good, Byzantine, bad, is basically a sum up of most of Gibbon's work, if you'd like, kind of thing, a dramatic summary. However, John is one of his few heroes. I mean, he has this line that sort of... Marcus Aurelius would not have disdained his successor of a millennium later or something like that, I think is his exact line, which interestingly is kind of directly almost from Coniates, as Gibbon seems to only use kind of, yeah, these sort of slightly imperfect major texts. Gibbon basically has, you know, who has just written this huge history of Rome, you know, from the beginning. He decides, oh, John sounds quite similar, and this has had a bit of a staying power kind of thing all the way through. So it's interesting sort of why he makes that, because obviously Marcus Aurelius is particularly, you know, known as sort of the philosopher emperor, all of these things. And, you know, aside from this one monastic charter, we have nothing from, you know, sort of written by John himself. So it's interesting that sort of that line is, so, you know, whether this is some sort of, you know, little accidental hint of, you know, the John we could have known had he lived a bit longer, you know, whether it's sort of its legal codes, whether anything like that. On the Byzantine Marcus Aurelius, this is an interesting line from Gibbon that is more or less sort of, you know, taken sort of from Coniates as well. Whether he deserves it, I don't know. I mean, we have no, I mean, John, he's very interested in, it seems, sort of, you know, the usual stuff, piety, whatever. But, I mean, without more texts actually written by John, aside from the military stuff, I'm not sure we can make the comparison, really.
No, fair enough. Well, speaking of the listeners then, I did ask the listeners for questions, so let's go through some of theirs. And I think we may have already touched, or we may have hinted at why. Why is John known as the good or the beautiful in some traditions, and do we know if that's justified?
Yeah, that's a fascinating one, particularly because it isn't just a Byzantine tradition. I mean, this appears in actually quite a few. So, I mean, William of Tyre, kind of, you know, sort of, you know, who, you know, sort of the Crusader historian, who sort of, you know, holds John up as a model of kind of, you know, Greek Crusader, you know, sort of cooperation, sort of mentions, oh yeah, he's sort of his lofty character, you know, famous for prowess in war, generous and pious, kind and merciful. And, you know, this, interestingly enough, is also sort of picked up by Ibn al-Athir, you know, sort of who, you know, sort of, you know, who is writing, you know, in Arabic and everything, and sort of mentions him as the merciful prince. He is using it slightly ironically as he praises, you know, Imad ad-Din Zengi as sort of the true sort of font of mercy. But even so, it's, you know, shows one of the enemies, you know, also sort of saying that, oh, yeah, this guy is known for his mercy. Particularly sort of, let's see, in the German tradition, and sort of John had a number of sort of letters out to the sort of German emperors there, you know, he refers to him as Kalli Johannes, so sort of, yeah, the Greek sort of, you know, sort of, you know, good John, yeah, so Kalos for good. Equally, the one of the sort of Balkan sources also sort of has, and also sort of in from Naples, also sort of used this sort of, you know, sort of good John. Ibn al-Adim also uses Kalyani, which is probably Kalli Johannes, moving through. So, I mean, and the only one we have from the time is we have the abbot of the church at Marseille sends a letter and a sort of a relic of sort of St. Victor, which is, yeah, the church at Marseille kind of thing, to the emperor as a gift. And he addresses him as Kalli Johannes as well. So, I mean, this is something that's used quite a lot, even during his lifetime. So, I mean, whether he has earned this particularly through some, you know, sort of, I mean, you know, maybe Coniates is right and he really did, you know, abolish the death penalty or something like that. But it is fascinating, and that he's earned this. I mean, the main sort of thing that people usually point to is the monastery he and his wife founded. As much as it's a monastery, it also had what is arguably the first kind of modern style hospital. I mean, that's a very sort of tendentious claim. There's various Arabic hospitals, etc., that have, you know, similarly in Italy. But I mean, this has dedicated wards for dedicated diseases. It has a staff to patient ratio that's probably better than most hospitals these days. Fascinatingly, it also has women's doctors for women's issues, which is you know, very you know, I mean, more or less unique for particularly the 12th century. And as a big sort of teaching aspect, only there must be doctors who teach other doctors to go forth to other places. And also it has an attached kind of retirement home, leper colony on a different island. Like, well, you know, this is a huge philanthropic thing. It also specifically says the doctors must not leave to treat private patients for money. They have to be there for whoever shows up. And so it's specifically for the poor. There is luckily another, actually, the monasteries in Constantinople is probably more aimed at sort of the rich, actually, funnily enough, so where Alexius is dying kind of thing, sort of around there. So yeah, so therefore this sort of philanthropic project that he and his wife do is likely sort of one of the major things he sort of earns this for. You know, and so between that, we only have sort of a very few sort of legal codes, but most of those are kind of relatively kind of, you know, progressive, which sort of say things like, sort of, you know, he particularly makes sure in the case of divorce that the kids of the marriage, and indeed kids of the adultery if there is any, both get some money. You know, there's a few of these kinds of things which are quite interesting, and sort of, you know, sort of, oh, there is injustice. I think John in some ways has a kind of I would like to be a good ruler thing going on. Yeah. Doesn't always succeed, but he, you know, definitely is like, okay, what would a good ruler do? And then he tries to do it, which is, you know, actually sort of relatively interesting on this stuff. So yeah, I mean, I'd say if anybody does earn this kind of, you know, John the good John thing, it's probably him. Sort of on this kind of stuff, admittedly, from what we can tell.
Yeah. Of course, the one place I have been from your whole book is the Pantocrator, which obviously is built up on a hill so that it dominates the skyline. So I'm being slightly cynical in my head, saying if John had really cared about the sick, he wouldn't have built it high up on a hill where they'd have to be wheeled up there to get treatment. But you can't really avoid that in Istanbul.
Definitely not. I would also say for the there's a good line that so for his triumph, where he very, and this is a, you know, great thing of his piety. He, you know, unlike the ancient Romans, he doesn't stand in the triumph in the chariot, you know, while, you know, all the cheering crowds and whatever it is. Instead, he puts an icon of the Virgin Mary in the chariot, And he sort of humbly sort of, you know, walks alongside, kind of thing. And admittedly, there's a great line, I think it's from one of these sort of general books on triumph that says, yes, so humbly walking alongside, you know, this golden chariot with a golden icon. I mean, it's about a spectacular a display of humility as you possibly can do. I mean, there he is, you know, sort of cheering crowds, the army following him, and they're, oh no, I'm just so humble walking alongside the golden chariot, whatever, you know. So yeah, I think there is a bit of a mix there. The sort of the lover of glory aspect is something else Koniatis says. And as we heard from the thing, I mean, a few times he does kind of overplay his hand a bit. So as much as, yes, he's doing what a good emperor would do, he's also trying to be, you know, Alexander the Great. He's trying to be, you know, sort of the great emperor. He doesn't always pull it off, of course.
Yes. I think it is probably impossible, isn't it, to marry true humility with the office of emperor. That, you just reminded me, of course, of Marcus Aurelius, who says, you know, don't get caught up in the glories of today, but I will be commissioning that spiral column about my my victory. So, you know,
fantastic.
Inevitable. Yeah. Anyway, let's stick to John. Another listener asked about Anna Komnene. Do we have any evidence of what she made of John's reign?
So this is a fascinating question. I know you had sort of Leonor Neville on before on this. So obviously, as you know, John is never mentioned directly in the Alexiad. And this, you know, sort of has usually been taken as sort of the first sign of sort of, oh, you know, Anna, you know, sort of never, you know, sort of, you know, always hated her brother and all this kind of stuff. And I think sort of the work Leonor Neville has done has been overdue when it comes to sort of rehabilitating the image of Anna as not actually this sort of, you know, sort of bitter old woman who sort of hated her her brother and nephew and everything else. Because it's, as sort of I mentioned earlier, sort of Anna, you know, seems to be quite happily at court. You know, sort of for most of the life. And, you know, her husband, Nicephorus Bryennius, is quite happily, you know, John's Caesar, his, you know, one of his second-hand, you know, second-in-commands, you know, goes with him to Antioch the first time. You know, they're very much kind of in the thick of it there. So, I mean, they can't have hated each other that much if they're quite happily going through. I think sort of, I mean, really it all depends what you think of this inverted commas coup, which is sort of, yeah, this elephant in the room here. Because, I mean, Koniatis is very explicit when it comes to Anna conspired against him, tried to have him killed, the whole, you know, and you wonder, of course, you know, sort of, I mean, how do you come back from that? And my answer to this is that actually sort of if you rely a little bit more on actually what Zonaras has to say on this. So Zonaras is a high-ranking imperial secretary under Alexius. And then at some time after that, so during John's reign, he retires and becomes a monk and then writes a history and indeed also a legal commentary and quite a few other things. He's quite prolific, which has led some people to suggest that maybe he sort of left under a cloud and actually was quite young when he became a monk. But anyway, Zonaras says clearly in the years before Alexius died that there is a moment when he was very ill. And he gave power to his wife to kind of look after while he was very ill. And then his wife empowered Nicephorus Bryennius and Anna. So therefore, in some ways, it's Nicephorus Bryennius who is sort of, he looks like he's about to take over. Who is, you know, said the Caesar, and therefore, you know, in some ways, he had the junior emperor, the sort of second in command anyway. And John, of course, is in his early 20s at this point. Now, Zonaras says very plainly that sort of, this is unacceptable to John. He wasn't, even though he'd been crowned co-emperor as a child, this was absolutely unacceptable. He's about to, you know, have, you know, he's got children of his own. He's got, you know, sort of a 3-year-old or something at that point. And therefore he wasn't going to be, you know, excluded from power for being too young. And then apparently John approaches various senators, so sort of nobles, other family members. This is where his brother Isaac first kind of backs him, it seems. And there's this kind of maneuvering. This is in about 1114 kind of thing. If Alexius died at that point. However, Alexius recovers. And therefore, in some ways, this, you know, this whole thing never actually happened. And then when 1118 rolls around, obviously John's had another 4 years to kind of, you know, really sort of be ready for when his father does actually die. And equally, he seems to have basically got everything on side at that point. I mean, he's very much got the support of the army. He's been leading his own campaign in Serbia kind of thing. He, you know, has really sort of got everything sorted by that point. And the what we have from Zonaras in particular is that, you know, initially this sort of image of, you know, John misses his own Alexis's funeral in order to kind of, you know, take control of the palace, which of course has the treasury and has all these sort of bits and pieces, you know, to sort of really make sure you, you know, you're firmly in command of the state. You know, at that point, it seems to be that what's mentioned is that they're not trying to actually have him killed. His mother, his sister, all the rest of it, they're not trying to actually have him murdered. What they're trying to do is essentially share power. Because previously, whenever Alexius was out of the capital, his wife, you know, sort of has been running things. And with her, Nikephoros Bryennios and Anna, you know, they've been kind of running Constantinople while Alexius and John were out campaigning. And it seems to me anyway that this, you know, Zonaras really sort of, who, you know, was there, he's, you know, in the government as a high-ranking sort of, you know, imperial secretary, just says it that what they wanted was this to continue. Whereas John says, no, I'd actually rather not do this. You know, I don't want to share the emperorship. I want to have it myself and then give it to people who I want. Yeah, he doesn't want his mother running things. He doesn't want his sister and brother-in-law running things. Though, funnily enough, his brother-in-law, A, does not get involved in any of this kind of stuff, and then also stays on as the Caesar, as his high-ranking general, everything else. And so I think that sort of Anna genuinely wanted her brother dead? No. I think that in some ways she, along with her mother, wanted to kind of, you know, have a share in the power, you know, maybe sort of make Nikephoros Bryennios officially co-emperor, who obviously was quite a bit older than John, and thereby sort of retain an official kind of, you know, powerful role in Constantinople, which actually John eventually gives to his brother Isaac instead, as the kind of Sebastocrator or sort of co-emperor, other, you know, figure in Constantinople. The other coup bit, which Coniates relates, this only mentions evil working men who essentially I assume were slightly dissatisfied with John in the first year or so, and therefore decide, oh, how about we sort of try and do something. Although it doesn't actually say necessarily that sort of Anna, etc., really involved. I mean, it's only Coniates who says this. So my general thoughts on sort of Anna and John is that initially it was probably a bit frosty, as she wanted a share in, you know, the power sharing arrangement, probably to, you know, follow her mother and indeed grandmother, because, you know, before she died kind of thing, you know, sort of Alexius's mother had sort of run things in Constantinople, you know, sort of thing. So therefore to basically continue in, you know, in the footsteps of her mother and grandmother as a kind of powerful figure in Constantinople. John said no, he'd rather give that to the people he decided were best, rather than kind of continue this. And, you know, initially, therefore, things frosty, but eventually, you know, more or less, I mean, you know, he gives her all the property back. You know, the kids have high-ranking positions. Nikephoros Bryennios is still in there. And it would be interesting to see whether Sir Nikephoros Bryennios, who's writing this history of Alexius, had he lived a little bit longer, whether he would have gone into John's reign. You know, what would a continuing history of Nikephoros Bryennios have looked like? Would have been quite interesting. So when it comes to Anna's reaction to John's reign, I would say that end of the day, no, she probably didn't absolutely hate her brother or anything else. Was she a little bit deprived of power by John's decision that he didn't want to continue the policy of his father? Yes. But that's kind of my possibly slightly controversial opinion, which sort of leans heavily into the Zonaras account rather than Savannah's own or some of the other ones, if that's kind of semi-answers that listener's questions. And all of that's more of an opinion.
Two more to go. So some listeners asked about the Roman Navy. This is a constant question, really. Why do the Romans not prioritize their navy more and so on? Can you tell us a bit about John's naval policies? As a reminder to the listeners, obviously, at the start of his reign, you've got the Venetians running amok, and it doesn't seem like there's a fleet that can stop them. But we then do see the fleet in action on the Danube and then supplying John's army in Syria. So what else do we know?
Sure. So this is the navy thing is something that if you read a lot of like general histories, whatever it is, that the idea goes that Alexius in particular gave these sort of trading rights to the Venetians in exchange for them being John, you know, them being the Comnenian navy, that essentially he sort of outsourced the navy to the Venetians, and then at some point the Venetians turned against him, and then it was all downhill from there, and this caused 1204 and the fall of the empire. And you read a lot of things which basically sort of put this, you know, through to Alexius or to John, particularly because, and they sort of pin this on John's finance minister, this guy called John Poutses. Coniates mentions in a sentence or so that John Poutses, in order to save money, decided to collect the taxes for the navy centrally. So rather than there being sort of a local tax that went to pay for a local defence fleet, sort of thematic fleet of the past era, instead this would be collected centrally and spent centrally on a central navy. And Coniates said this was a terrible idea, and this kind of, you know, got rid of the navy entirely. And this is therefore, you know, usually held up as one of those things that means the end of Byzantium in 1204. But you've got a few different, you know, a few other sort of little wrinkles in here. One is the fact that Coniates absolutely hates John Poutses. Any time he brings this guy up, it is always derogatory. He talks about him, so trying to cheat market sellers and, like, you know, so all of these little anecdotes about John Poutses, you know, so he talks, you know, bad things about his wife as well, and, like, you know, saying she's a sort of, you know, a member of a decayed aristocratic family. Anything Coniates says about Poutses is very coloured for some reason. Kind of thing. He sort of comes to a sticky end in Manuel's reign after having amassed too much power, it seems, and therefore is sort of remembered badly. And the other thing was that sort of during this Venetian conflict, the local thematic fleets are still there. I mean, sort of this reform actually happens after this. And so, you know, the situation gets a little bit more complicated. And looking into it, it seems that even under Alexius and before, you have lots of criticism, even in some Kekomenos and things, you have criticism of the local naval leaders basically just taking all the money and not spending it on local fleet at all. Essentially, this local tax had been a big issue for a while. Because I think you read these sources and you have this idea that the thematic fleets were kind of plucky, kind of, you know, local men, sort of, you know, fishermen most of the time, and then occasionally sort of, you know, heroically standing up for Byzantium kind of thing, so defending Rome kind of thing, and then, you know, really they just want to get back to their families, and this is kind of, you know, a bit like the old thematic armies. Whereas actually, sort of reading the things, there is huge criticism about these guys being completely unprofessional, and all of the money not actually being spent on them anyway. And I think the sort of the real change happens with, as I said, this Venetian fleet that goes over to help the Crusaders in the Levant, and then comes back. And this is a major naval force, which is actually not something that Byzantium has had to deal with for quite a few hundred years. I mean, essentially, when Byzantium is fighting a few pirates or the odd sort of Fatimid raiding party, it doesn't really, you know, localized defense fleets make sense. This is ideal, actually, to have a sort of decentralized thing in order to kind of deal with these sort of raids, deal with pirates, that kind of thing. But they're not dealing with that anymore. They're dealing with a major centralized naval force going out to the east, particularly the Venetians, but then also sort of, you know, other powers, you know, from the west starting to come over. And therefore, little localized defense fleets is going to do absolutely nothing against a major centralized fleet. Equally, I mean, I take the modern example. I mean, name one country in the world today that has a decentralized naval forces. I mean, you know, generally, I mean, I'd say sort of the reform comes in because they think, okay, look, we have these large fleets that go over as one fleet out to the east now to deal with. Therefore, we need a large centralized fleet in order to deal with that. And therefore, that's what they do, kind of thing. And equally, that gets rid of the problem of the whole localized thing. The accounts of, you know, sort of piracy and all this sort of stuff, that all comes from right at the end of the century. The idea that sort of, you know, oh, well, there's all of these raids and the Norman raid and all of these kinds of things, that all comes up much later. And so during John's reign, and indeed for Manuel, you know, actually everything's sort of doing pretty well after this reform. As we said, sort of, you know, he uses it extensively on the Danube. My general theory is that sort of actually lots of John's campaigns, he's entirely being supplied by sea. You know, because I mean, particularly sort of when his son dies, you know, they go back by sea immediately. And sort of that's how he's able to cut through Cilicia and through to Antioch so quickly, is that he's being resupplied by the navy the whole time. And of course, you know, Manuel, I mean, he launches invasions of Egypt and all this kind of, you know, you don't do that with no navy. And so the idea that sort of this finance reform got rid of the Byzantine navy is basically just definitely not true, because you have all these massive invasions, and I mean, John uses the navy a lot. And that, so my general thing is that, so the navy declines along with a lot of other things when the Angeloi come in later. And actually, so during John's reign, you have this sort of centralization in order to face the changed threat of the fact that there are these sort of large centralized navies coming in rather than small raiding parties and everything else, if that roughly sums it up.
Yeah, well, that, and it sort of directly leads us to 1204 and large navies coming to Constantinople. We're into the realm of theory now, because obviously lots of listeners wanted to know, you know, 1204 hangs over John. It's no spoiler alert to say that you think John is a good emperor, that the book makes a case for him being a good emperor. Do you get the sense that something like the Fourth Crusade was inevitable even at the end of John's reign, or had the emperors coming after him been as good as he was, could that have been managed or avoided?
Counterfactual is always fun, of course, but so had John actually imposed some sort of settlement on Antioch, this would have at the very least probably averted the Second Crusade, because I mean, had essentially there been either sort of John actually took over both Antioch and maybe even Edessa too, with kind of maybe, you know, maybe not sort of fully, but let's say the sort of the Crusader princes there as his sort of clients, or even sort of vassals in the Western sense.
Sorry to jump in. Apologies to interrupt. Just for any listeners who aren't aware, I think about 3 years after John dies, Edessa is taken by the Emir of Mosul, and that prompts the Second Crusade, which sort of leads to a worsening of relations between Byzantium and the Latins. Sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
No, I should have said it myself. Thank you. Yes, I mean, had John, I mean, either, you know, either successfully managed to bring that into the aegis or just lived a bit longer, the Second Crusade would have been averted. And had, therefore, there been that kind of settlement, either sort of John living a bit longer, or indeed maybe his eldest son not dying, the intended sort of heir, who was you know sort of very much sort of, you know, yeah, already been crowned emperor, the whole deal was very much there. I mean, there is this kind of moment of, great, my eldest son has died, and my other, you know, the second son has died. Now he's got one son in Constantinople, and then the youngest son with him. What is he going to do? Then he thinks, well, at least I've probably got a few years in Constantinople to sort this out, and then suddenly he's dying. So I mean, that could, you know, because I mean, had he also, you know, taken Iconian, you know, that also then suddenly would have, you know, really knocked out the sort of central authority in lots of these sort of Turkish states. You'd have got sort of a lot of these sort of things happening. But even sort of assuming sort of John dies as you know, sort of as he did in, you know, sort of regular history, and also sort of Manuel takes over. I mean, a lot of these also, I mean, you'll talk a lot more about Manuel. But in some ways, sort of John's tendencies towards kind of, you know, sort of glory seeking, oh, but, you know, maybe I can do this and I can do that. And of course, sometimes he does. I mean, conquering Cilicia in one campaign is huge. Not to mention, you know, sort of the Pechenegs and everything else. So, I mean, had Manuel sort of pulled off a few of his gambles, I mean, had he actually, you know, held on to southern Italy for more than a decade, had the Egyptian expedition worked, had, you know, the Myriocephalon campaign not to, I mean, there's a lot of these which sort of almost work out, and have, I think, even just one of these worked out, and, you know, Byzantium would have been in a very different place. But I say my general thing is that, so John, his achievements, I mean, Alexius John, then Manuel, managed to turn what had been Turkish-occupied Anatolia into, you know, Byzantine territory again. And that's where, you know, the sort of the Nicene Empire would turn up after 1204. I mean, this Byzantine state that was on Turkish land for a while suddenly ends up being the sort of the heir to Constantinople. And so, I mean, that's a huge achievement in and of itself that isn't usually recognized, that sort of these places that sort of Alexius, John, Manuel reconquer end up surviving Constantinople. You know, which is sort of big in itself. So could the whole thing have been averted? I mean, personally, I'd say lots of this stuff is due to more short-term factors for the Angeloi. There isn't necessarily some great systemic weakness that dates all the way back to Alexius. Could, therefore, things have been different? Had a few of these things gone another way? Definitely. would be mine. I mean, there's a lot of kind of, you know, these sort of grand, I don't know, jigsaw puzzles, which they're all sort of doing. And I think particularly, you know, he's trying to sort out the Balkans and sort out Anatolia and sort out the Crusaders and sort out, you know, all of these things all at the same time. And had he, or, you know, sort of his son Alexis who dies, or Manuel managed to, like, finish some of those jigsaws, then, I mean, everything's different.
Would be
what I said. So if I, in general, I would say 1204 is much more due to short-term factors, which would be another podcast, I'm sure.
Absolutely. And that's come up repeatedly, actually, of course, when you do a podcast over 1,000 years, that lots of medieval states just got swept away by one defeat. And it's not necessarily that they were declining and falling, but if you destroy someone's capital, it can destroy their whole state and something new grows up. But anyway, I think we'll have to call it quits for today, but we owe you a huge debt of gratitude, both for your work and for letting us have the benefit of it before publication. I will, of course, be back on to announce to the listeners when the book comes out. Dr. Lau, thank you so much for your amazing work and for speaking to us today.
Absolute pleasure. You know, thank you very much for having me on.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.